Ian, we're going to do a special episode for the new series of the podcast all about Russian money laundering and corruption and all the accountants and lawyers who make that possible. Is there anything you'd like to add just before we begin?
I'd just like to say, oh, great, you're doing a piece about how unbelievably rich Russians are paying the best and most expensive lawyers in London to come at people with money, no object. Oh, great. Yeah, terrific.
Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Page 94. This week we have a special episode all about dodgy Russian money making its way into the British financial system. A few issues ago, Private Eye ran a special report entitled Looting with Putin. And that report covered all the ways in which money makes its way out of the Russian system and into the British one. The current issue of the magazine has also covered how little the British government is doing to stop this process, presumably on the basis that it's better to have the money inside the system than it is not to let it in the first place. The author of that special report and of the latest coverage is The Eye's Richard Brooks, so we decided to set him the unenviable task of boiling down an incredibly complicated system of shell companies and stolen cash, dodgy lawyers and the whole lot into one half-an-hour podcast. He said yes, more fool him. However, we did let him set a start date, and he chose the early 1990s. To explain why, here's Richard.
If you go back to the very early 90s, following the breakup of the Soviet Union, they sensed a huge commercial opportunity. We all know there was a wave of very corrupt privatizations, and that was, you know, manna from heaven for a certain type of lawyer and accountant. And those types were actually the largest, the elite lawyers and accountants.
So in the last series of Page 94, we talked about the big four bean counters, the accountancy firms, that in many cases turned a blind eye to problems which were happening in the Western financial system.
Yeah.
So for example, the financial crash and all the big banks which had been receiving very clean bills of health from the big four accountants for years and years, and no alarms were being raised about dodgy financial products being shuffled around there. You're saying that firms like PwC, Ernst & Young, KPMG didn't have a presence in the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so when the old Soviet Union fell apart, they saw an opportunity to account lots of new banks which were just being pulled into the capitalist system.
Yes. And not just the banks, but also the major industrial companies that were privatized, like Gazprom.
Okay, yes. You've written about Gazprom.
The companies that were effectively handed to the oligarchs.
Yeah.
And they immediately became part of this kind of web of Soviet corruption, which meant that they would siphon off money to cronies of Putin, to a network who would then reinforce the regime. But it was all very corrupt, and it should not have passed muster with an independent, scrupulous accountant.
So you've written about Gazprom. Gazprom was the official state oil and gas firm?
Yeah, it's the largest gas firm in Russia.
Yeah,
and it sort of functions as an arm of the state and is used as a route for the regime to get money into certain pockets with dodgy contracts.
Right.
And so on, contracts with companies controlled by friends of Putin.
Okay.
And, you know, in return, he gets supported in office by this network.
So the auditors of Gazprom were PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yeah.
Now, I can understand the advantage to PricewaterhouseCoopers of auditing a huge new firm like Gazprom. Mm. It's an enormous firm. There'll be lots of money to be made doing the accounts.
Yeah.
What are the advantages for Gazprom to be audited by PwC?
Well, firms like PwC come with a very strong reputation. You know, we can argue about how deserved that is, but they do have a strong reputation. Bringing in the big four accountancy firms to audit these new private companies was seen as a way of vouching for their probity, really, saying that, look, this is a respectable kind of setup we now have.
Yeah.
And firms like PwC played along with that.
So one of Gazprom's shareholders was the hedge fund Hermitage, and they suspected there might be something going on. They demanded an inquiry into it, and then Gazprom said, we can look into it, but only if the inquiry is conducted by PwC.
Yes. So they came in and marked their own homework, which is fairly common practice, you know, in the West, which they exported to Russia. Yeah, and they found there was nothing untoward. But it was clear, you know, so many people over the years have looked at the finances of Gazprom and found that for a near-monopoly gas firm in Russia, which is quite a good position to be in, they're not making that much money. And in fact, more recently, an analyst from a bank, he got sacked for his troubles, but he said that Gazprom are actually quite good at what they set out to do, because they don't set out to make money for honest shareholders. They set out to make money for people who are connected to the regime. So this is the nature of the company.
And what you're saying is that this is still going on. So that's the historical context of, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union. But you're saying that this is an ongoing practice.
Yes, completely. The most recent reports on Gazprom are from last year. Nothing's really changed.
So this isn't the only way that PwC are involved, is it?
No, PwC were the most important firm in Russia. There was a WikiLeaks cable that came out in 2006 that said that PwC had audited companies that were worth more than 50% of Russian GDP. So they were the big operator out there. One of their clients was Yukos, and it was perhaps the only big company that actually restated its accounts and admitted it had got them wrong.
And is Yukos gas and oil? Is it a bank?
Yukos is another oil company, yeah. But it's one where whose chief executive, a chap called Mikhail Khodorkovsky, had fallen out with Putin because he had broken the rule that said that these oligarchs mustn't get involved in politics. So Putin wanted to take him out. So he insisted that Yukos admit that its accounts were wrong. And at that point, PwC did what was required and said, oh yes, sorry, we got it wrong all those years. You know, they can speak out, but only when they're told to by the main man.
Okay. So let's leave the big four accountancy firms for a moment and talk about banking, because this is another big method by which money is siphoned out and away from where it should be into private pockets.
Yeah.
The bank Parex is a really interesting case. This is a Latvian bank that was set up, I think, in the early 90s, perhaps? Maybe in the late 80s.
Yeah, the very early 90s, yeah. Set up really to get money out of the former Soviet region.
Yeah.
You know, once you've stolen this money, you need to get it somewhere, like London, maybe. So you need a route out. And Latvia, which, you know, has a long trading tradition, decided that it would, when it became independent, it would become the place to use the sort of banking capital, a sort of Switzerland on the Baltic,
right.
It styled itself. It's useful to have these kind of staging posts because they have a certain respectability. So Latvia would claim it had a well-developed financial system, that it regulated these banks well. It was on its way to joining the European Union. So it was seen as part of the club, part of the respectable financial club. And if you can get your money into a bank there, it's then easier to get it into the mainstream financial system.
Yeah. Let's say I'm an oligarch. I've got $1 billion burning a hole in my pocket. Because Gazprom's not done very well this year. It's very sad indeed, but for some reason I've got this extra $1 billion.
Yeah.
So I would open an account with Parex, who offers Swiss-style numbered accounts.
Yeah, they did all that. I think they essentially modelled their banking services on the Swiss.
Okay. And once I've got it, let's say, anonymously into Parex, into a Latvian bank, I can then use that money to buy, for example, property in London, or
probably through another bank as well. A lot of money went from the former Soviet countries to Latvia, through Austria, and then into the UK, and then maybe out again, some of it. People with dirty money to hide tend to put a few steps in, but this was the key step. And they also probably hold the account not in their own name, but in the name of some shell company that they set up either in a tax haven or, as we've reported before in the Eye, UK shell companies, which give another layer of supposed respectability. So you'd find that, in fact, one case that I mentioned in the report was a fraud on the Ukrainian health budget, 60 million quid, that was run through a UK shell company that itself was ultimately owned by the fraudsters, but looked respectable and passed Parex Bank's money laundering controls. So the money went through from Ukraine through Parex Bank in the name of this UK shell company, and then out into various places to buy assets and, you know, essentially shelter the money.
And when you say UK shell company, is this one that's set up in a UK overseas territory, for example? So
this was Enfield, okay, to be precise.
Enfield.
Yeah. There are not many palm trees in Enfield. There might be one or two, but there's a huge shell company industry in the UK, not just limited companies, things called limited liability partnerships. Mm. In Scotland, there are these things called Scottish limited partnerships. And they are very opaque, secret corporate vehicles,
yeah,
that people can use to essentially to hide money. And then they can file fake accounts in the UK and they never get checked.
But I thought that you had to declare the ultimate ownership of the company. I thought this was a recent
victory. Well, this is a new rule.
That's a new
rule. A lot of this predates that rule, which came in 2016. But even that rule is pretty worthless at the moment because it's just not policed.
Right.
We've reported the existence of hundreds of obviously dodgy supposed beneficial owners. Company's House doesn't police the system at all. So in fact, it can do more harm than good because the UK gets a big tick in the box for having introduced transparency in these shell companies. You know, and banks are reassured by that, but if it's not actually operating, because crooks don't mind lying on a form that they file at Company's House, then, you know, it actually sort of gives a rubber stamp to a criminal system.
Yes, and this is something that's in the latest edition of the mag, isn't it? Which is about the number of people devoted to fighting this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. One of the, or perhaps the most important part of that effort is something called the Financial Intelligence Unit within the National Crime Agency. About 10 years ago, the UK promised that it would double the number of people in there from 100 to about 200, because we were already coming under criticism for not policing money laundering. Since then, the number's not gone up to 200. It's actually fallen to 80. Even while, you know, papers and magazines like The Eye have been writing about this kind of rampant money laundering through London. So, you know, that's a very short-sighted cut on the government's part, you know, when it now professes to be really serious on the issue.
Yeah. And Company's House is another interesting one, isn't it? Because Company's House sounds like a very big and official thing.
Yeah.
But I think you've pointed out that they don't have the resources to check the enormous number of companies that are being set up and the information that's being declared for these companies.
Yeah. They you know, Company's House, if it were in a library, it would be filed under fiction. You know, because you can just put anything into Company's House. Right. And it's the chance of being caught filing false information is vanishingly small. The only person who's recently been prosecuted for that was someone who set out to draw attention to the problem and to himself. He set up companies using as directors Vince Cable, who was then business secretary at the time, and another minister who was in charge of Company's House, just to point out how absurd the whole thing was. And this irritated them so much that they prosecuted him. But nobody else gets prosecuted. All the Russians and all the lawyers and accountants who set up these companies for them never get prosecuted. And of course, we've written about Conservative MP Marcus Fish, who's filed clearly false accounts for a company of his and false company returns. But no action seems to be taken against that.
Just to zoom out briefly on what we've got so far, you've got corruption happening and accountants not really dealing with that, looking the other way, because they've got very large contracts with these companies, which are siphoning money off.
The key step there, I think, also with the accounts, is we talked about Parex Bank, which was one of a number of Latvian banks dedicated to money laundering. The auditors didn't say a word about that. Now, that's something they really should have picked up on, where there are material levels of corruption. It's an auditor's job, one of its jobs, to pick that up. And indeed, in the Parex case, we explain in the report how a whistleblower pointed all this out to Ernst & Young, who were the auditors at the time, and they just brushed it under the carpet, did nothing.
And I think they sacked him as well. Business.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of almost goes without saying for a whistleblower, sadly.
And I think it's also important to point out the actual consequences of this, because it seems so remote from everyday life. Mm. It's quite easy, I think, to say, this doesn't really affect me. You know, this is crime going on, but it's, you know.
Well, this is the way that, without being too dramatic about it, that a regime like Vladimir Putin survives. It can only survive through corruption, and corruption can only thrive if there are the channels for the money to flow through.
Mm. So, we've got the accountants in one corner. We've got the banks, which are assisting with money laundering elsewhere.
Yeah.
Can we talk briefly about the lawyers? Because it is a very, very complicated system.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, you took six densely typed pages to take an overview of it in your special report.
Well, the lawyers, you know, they come with perhaps the loftiest reputation. Yeah, we've got to get this past our own lawyers. and they too have become very profit motivated. You can find it's interesting in the report we have in this issue about Clifford Chance, the senior partner at that firm, or the last senior partner, he left and he said, you know, he was asked about what he could have done differently. He said, well, he wished he'd made more profit per equity partner. It's a sort of technical way of saying he wished they'd trousered some more muller from their clients. And that's really what city law firms are about. They're commercial operations. Now, they do come with professional codes, ethics, and laws, of course, that they have to comply with. But that still gives them a lot of room to apply their judgment. They decide how to behave. You know, they decide whether they are about ensuring the laws applied properly or whether they're about using the law to make as much money for themselves and their clients. What I've found is that they're erring on the side of the latter more than you might want them to.
Do you have an example of how these law firms are helping their large clients to game the system?
Well, I think that they sort of happily play along with all the big deals that are the bedrock of the system. So if you look at the last 20 years, I suppose, in Russia, the big corporate finance deals, the big privatizations, listing of companies on the London Stock Exchange, all these big deals that enrich the oligarchs, the lawyers have been there making sure they work.
Right.
Because there are huge fees in them, millions of pounds of fees in any particular deal. Back in 2006, for example, Linklaters, who are the biggest Magic Circle law firm, biggest operator in the Russian corporate finance market, they helped an oil company called Rosneft list on the London stock market. Its business was essentially, or most of it, had been stolen from Yukos, the company we talked about earlier. So there were serious concerns about whether this was an ethical thing for a law firm to be doing. Probably legal. They're probably not breaking any laws doing it. But, you know, it's certainly questionable. We quoted the Linklaters senior partner over in Russia saying that, Russia was high risk, high reward.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think it was much higher reward than it was risk for a law firm, because they never seem to come out on the wrong end.
Are the lawyers, like the consultancy arms of the accountancy firms, are they just offering advice on how to make sure that everything goes through?
Yeah, you know, there is a huge amount of legal work to be done
right.
on any deal. It can't happen without everything being lawyered to death.
Much like this podcast.
Yeah.
Hello, Robin, if you're listening.
But also, the important thing about the large law firms, like the accountancy firms signing off the accounts of a company, the important role that a big law firm has in a corporate finance deal is saying that, effectively, that it's all above board.
So we've got the accountants, we've got the banks, we've got the lawyers now as well. Yeah. So, yes, the question is, why go along with any of this? If there were ways to keep this appropriated money out and to stop supporting this corruption?
Well, I think the answer is that successive governments have wanted the money in to the UK. Prime ministers have always been going on trade visits to Moscow. Law firms, accountancy firms are a significant source of import earnings. The house market gets inflated. Estate agents do well. I mean, it's all counterproductive, but there's an immediate superficial attraction to that money coming in. Some short-term tax receipts from people spending money in the UK. So people like, you know, Tony Blair encouraged it. David Cameron encouraged it. He was always going on trade visits. He went on a couple of trade visits over there, took the lawyers and accountants with him. Ken Clark, when he was Justice Secretary back in the early stages of the coalition government, said that Britain should be the lawyer and advisor to the world. It's part of how British governments have seen our role in the world for quite a few years. And that has trumped concerns over, you know, where the money's coming from.
And I guess that accounts for things like the investor visa, for example.
Yeah.
Where if you've got £1 million to spend, welcome in.
Yeah, and it's all part of the phony competition between countries for rich people. We have investor visas, which came in 96, which gives you some idea of the sort of origins of all this, the time we're looking at. And then we've persisted with tax breaks for non-domiciled people. It's all to get the richest people in. And of course, you know, why do we want that? Well, there are some short-term financial benefits, but there's also, you know, they fund political parties as well, certainly given money to the Tories quite recently. The law firms love it, and they're very well connected. So it all kind of feeds into some very influential people who've done very well out of it. The longer-term consequences, or the consequences that are a bit more remote, the corruption, the deaths and so on, you know, they don't feature too much in weighing up the policy, or they never did in the past.
Yeah. So one of the other things you cover in your report, actually, is the property market and how this is augmented, pumped up, boosted by corruption and money laundering overseas.
Yeah. The British property market is almost the perfect place for an oligarch to put his dirty money, because it's safe, it generally retains its value. You actually get some use out of the asset. You can live in a house. You can base yourself here. You can send your children to private schools. It's the perfect asset. So the industry that we've been talking about, particularly the law firms, have been really diligent in serving this market. You know, there are a number of sort of not magic circle, but second-tier law firms that are particularly enthusiastic in helping people spend their money in London to buy houses. You know, the question is, should they be doing that? There are money laundering rules that are pretty strict when it comes to things like transactions, like buying houses. So they should be looking carefully at where the money's coming from.
And obviously there might also be very good reasons why you would want to leave the Soviet Union and why you want to buy a house in the UK. We're not suggesting the entire market is illegal.
No, we're not. a lot of it is, you know, I do sometimes ask myself, well, how do you make £1 million in Russia? Honestly, I suppose it is possible. But of course, you are in this grey area, whether someone who comes in with £1 million, whether it is corruptly acquired or whether that person's just done well within that system.
Yeah.
And legitimately. And for the people who are processing these transactions, the estate agents, but more importantly, the lawyers, because they're the ones we expect a bit more of, it comes down to a question of judgment. You know, you have to make a judgment about where this person's got the money from, often based on incomplete information.
And various people who've covered this sort of dodgy behaviour in the UK, British journalists, have been on the receiving end of lawsuits as a result of it.
Yes. It's very easy for a big law firm to accept a lot of money to take up a libel suit, usually against magazines, papers who can't afford to defend it. You know, there have been some very high-profile examples. Bill Browder, who we talked about, who owned the hedge fund that's taken on a lot of corrupt Russian business and campaigned about to expose the killing of his lawyer in a prison in Moscow.
Sergei Magnitsky.
Sergei Magnitsky, yeah. He was taken to court by the two Russian policemen who earn about £12,000 a year each, who he said were involved in this. When the case was chucked out as an abusive process, Browder lost all his money, all his costs, and the policemen were nowhere to be found.
Right.
Somehow they'd been able to afford Olswang's fees of, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds, and he was left high and dry. So they will step in where the money is.
Yeah.
And of course, the people you're dealing with, the most serious people, have a lot of money and a lot more than the people they're taking on. That also applies when it comes to the press. You know, we reported a local paper, the Hammond High, that wasn't even allowed to say that one oligarch owned a house on their patch because they couldn't afford to contest, you know, the lawsuit. Other people have said it, we've said it, but they were kind of forced to take down their article. So, you know, there's an industry in reputation protection.
Mm.
That's a major part of what a big group of law firms are now doing. The starting point isn't, oh, let's right this wrong. Mm. It's let's protect this reputation and use the law to do it. It's similar in principle to how the corporate lawyers are approaching corporate deals. They're thinking, you know, let's get this big money deal through rather than let's make sure the business is correct.
So I think we're getting close to the stage where I ask, what is to be done? So we've got so many different angles to the whole story in terms of reputation management, lawyers, accountants, banks. The whole thing is very complicated, and it seems that the tools that the British government has at its disposal, or that it's willing to use, are pretty few and far between.
Yeah.
Is there a prospect of change in this, or do you suspect not?
There is. At the moment, there's some appetite. There are some good people on the case. If you look at, you know, a lot of the law enforcers you hear talking about the subject really get it. And there are certainly some good intentions. But I think the question is over the resources to do anything about it. And the government doesn't seem willing to put in what is required. Now, that's a political choice. It may be tied up with, you know, uncertainty over Brexit and what our economic fortunes are and what sort of country we want to be. The problem has its roots, as we were talking about earlier, in this sort of desire to attract money, which, although it's counterproductive in the long run, has an immediate attraction. And we seem to be suffering from that again, you know, in the Brexit era.
That's a typically depressing ending.
Can we have some jokes now?
Richard Brooks there. And after that special report, Looting with Putin, was published, there have even been some interesting after effects in the heart of British government, as the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop, will now reveal.
Yes, I mean, this is incredibly important. We had a letter from a reader saying that he was on the train to Maidenhead from Paddington, and someone from Chatham House, the very prestigious think tank, was sitting next to him on the train. And the person from Chatham House pulled out of his suitcase the special report, Looting with Putin. But it was a photocopy of the special report, which suggested they had reproduced it in order to pass it amongst themselves to make sure they were informed at the highest possible level. I mean, that was pretty flattering, so I printed that letter. Lo and behold, the next issue, we have a new subscriber. It's the Library and Information Services Manager from Chatham House, who writes in saying, well, of course, we shouldn't just be, you know, photocopying this. And he's ordered a copy to be put in Chatham House Library, and he's filled out a subscription and says this is what his members deserve, which is an incredible result. That's one copy sold, which for us is always good.
Especially after everyone cancelled their subscriptions due to the Philip Green cover.
And one copy sold will replace, well, not all of the subscriptions cancelled after the Philip Green cover, but certainly some of them. And it was certainly salutary seeing the response to the Philip Green cover, because I've generally said that I think people are very rude on Twitter and seem to be without control. But a number of handwritten letters came in, pushed through the door, one of them saying, this is not satire, fuck off, Hislop, you c-. So thank you very much for that.
That's it for this week's episode of Page 94. My thanks to Ian and to Richard Brooks, and we will be back again in a fortnight with another episode. We hope you enjoyed this one, and we hope to see you then. Goodbye.